You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mixtape Memories. I'm Matt Hart-Spade.
And I'm Jen Erz.
And today we have a special guest, Bill Paris from Brooklyn Vegan. How you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Good, all things considering. You know. Right? I know.
Sure. I think everything that we say these days in regards to that sort of stuff, things that you're looking forward to in the future, there's just that invisible asterisk, you know, by everything.
Exactly.
Yes, I know. I feel like there's so many memes about how people start their emails these days. Hey, how are you doing? Are you okay? Hope this finds you well.
Yeah.
I know. Like, how has it been going for you through the pandemic?
It's going all right. I mean, as far as my job with Brooklyn Vegan, that part doesn't really change too much because I've worked from home the entire time that I've worked there. I live by myself, so I don't have to, you know, worry about other people who have been places that I don't know where they've been in my apartment. It's just, you know, I haven't gone to see a show in a year, which has to be the longest I've gone since I started going to see shows. So,
yeah, I was going to say, because, I mean, how many on average were you seeing pre-pandemic? At least a few a week, no?
Yeah, you know, like, especially if it was this time in a normal year, like in March, when all the bands are touring around South by Southwest, you could it could be 5 shows in a week or something. But yeah, average probably 2 to 3 a week, I would say.
Yeah, and have you like checked out any virtual stuff like at all?
I watch the occasional thing. If there's an artist that I like that I see is doing something, I'll watch that. You know, I watched a couple of the Ben Gibbard ones when he was doing like almost nightly, you know. I'll check in with some other stuff, but not too much, you know. I'm spent more time like revisiting like TV shows and stuff like that than, you know, for me, like I don't watching a live show on your laptop or even on your TV is just not the same as like actually going. So it doesn't quite have the same appeal to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have kind of Zoom and just web burnout from viewing and watching various performances. But yeah, it's not the same. I think, you know, I've realized this obviously over the course of the last year, but I think it really struck me a few weeks ago. I purchased the Mogwai live stream around their new album. I've seen Mogwai 20 times through the years. To watch it on a screen is just, I mean, it just paled in comparison. It was terrible. You know, I mean, terrible in comparison, just that you can't be in the moment, you know?
There's just something you can't capture in a virtual way that you can when you're actually at the show and you can actually feel the music hit you.
For
like
sure.
Everything that the show brings to it with the production. But I feel like it's interesting how some venues have, like, dealt with the issues and trying to survive and stuff. So, and like, you know, you mentioning that the Brooklyn Vegan South by Southwest showcase, they like built up Mohawk in a virtual space. I think that's cool. You know, Elsewhere did that too. They built Elsewhere into like a virtual space.
I didn't actually check that out. They actually did that. It was,
yeah, but supposedly like they like hired somebody to like build it in Minecraft.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and so it like kind of created this like, you kind of felt like you were at the venue.
Wow.
And they really, I'm kind of impressed with how they like really built that into a business and even struck a deal with Twitch now for that.
Oh, I didn't know that. Right.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to see how people are like taking advantage of like this new medium that's out there and using it as like a revenue stream. With this podcast, I feel like it's kind of fun because we're like really going back to like the more bare bones days and talking about like mixtapes and stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you have like mixtape memories?
I do. You know, I was a big mixtape person.
I can see you being a very good curator.
Yes.
Of the mixtape.
I was definitely probably a little too far into, like, I was trying to, teach is not the right word, but like, you know, I had like a mission with my mixtapes, and, you know, it definitely was not like trying to think of like a DJ set where, you know, people are dancing, or I was probably a little too highbrow with them, which, you know, when it comes to, you know, everybody made mixtapes for somebody that they liked or something. And
yeah,
I was never very successful in that regard. But I made a lot. And I also like would make them for like bars and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Didn't you make stuff for Snackies?
Yeah, there was a restaurant bar in Williamsburg that opened in like 2002. And I used to make mix CDs because it was just in the CDR era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I made mix CDs for them until their CD player died. And then we sort of switched to an iPod, and I programmed their iPod up until they closed, which was about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the old school scroll wheel.
Oh, I love that.
You know, 160 gig iPod.
Didn't you recently find one of those of your own?
I did. I don't remember what
I saw that on social media somewhere.
Yeah, I was going through a closet looking for something. Oh, you know what? I think I was probably looking for a box of photos to find something old for you guys for the site. And I didn't. And I pulled out a box, and it was a box of cassettes, actually. Mostly like promo cassettes and a few. I don't know what they were, but in there was a big scroll wheel iPod that I found the cord to somewhere and powered it up, and it still works. I haven't listened to it,
oh, but yeah,
I posted an Instagram photo, and I think it's got Pulp's His and Hers in the cover flow. So,
oh man, I remember when that first came out. One of my coworkers at the time like had one, and like, when I saw it, I was like, what the hell is that? Because I feel like at that point, like, I don't even remember what, like, music players were out, but, like, they were kind of janky.
They were very janky.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like in college, I had one of those, like, very early models of MP3 player that just, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. It wasn't it. But then once the iPod came out, obviously it changed everything dramatically.
Totally. I mean, Now it's like our phones.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
But do you remember Zune?
Sure. Who doesn't remember Microsoft's brown, native player? Yeah.
They tried. Failed.
They did try. It was a good effort.
I had a friend who really defended the Zune, and like up until they stopped like making the software for it, he was just like, "This is still the way to go." You know, like I'm gonna. All my money's on Zune, and he probably ended up buying the whatever that Neil Young Pono, was that what it was called? The thing that looked like it looked like a Toblerone.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. God, that totally. I haven't thought about that in a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering what your thoughts are going back to cassettes on kind of this cassette resurgence, if you will. I mean, it's not this massive resurgence, but to some degree, there's this resurgence, and I guess I was just wondering what your thoughts were. And I mean, obviously the audio quality is terrible compared to, you know, digital format and vinyl, but do you miss maybe the sense of like that little piece of memorabilia, that little collector's item?
Not really.
That's fair.
I'll say I'm not sure the cassettes are any worse than whatever the bitrate is for Spotify, you know, the average Spotify user. I think it's less than we think it is. And definitely, you know, like I still get, I still use a lot of MP3 stuff because I'm like, I listen to a lot of stuff offline or, you know, and I'll still get sent stuff that's like 160, you know, K, wow. which is not very good.
No.
I have fond memories of cassettes. I have fond memories of mixtapes, but the cassette as a purchased format just seemed like a waste to me. Mm-hmm. They would melt, they would break, they would get stuck in your car stereo.
Mm-hmm.
They were only ever purchased out of desperation for me. Like, I feel like it was if I couldn't, you know, when I was a kid, like a teenager, I would buy it if I couldn't find it in any other format.
Mm-hmm.
Or you were at a record store cutout bin where it was for 99 cents and you're like, oh, I can have this for the car. Mm-hmm. Or a truck stop.
Truck stop.
And you're on like a road trip and you need something new and here's this, you know, Conway Twitty or Foreigner record and you're like, what the hell, I'll buy this, you know? But
mm-hmm.
it's like the most disposable medium, and like disposable because it breaks and you end up having to throw it away. And
exactly, yeah, yeah.
But I went home for Christmas to my parents' place a few years ago, and we had parked the car in the garage, and there was this gigantic wooden crate, like huger than a Coleman cooler, probably 4 feet long and 2 feet deep and 2 feet tall. And my parents are like, all your cassettes are in there. And I'm like, what cassettes? She's like, well, when we emptied out like your car when you moved to New York and your other stuff, we just threw it all in there. And I was like, that whole thing is full of cassettes? And I like opened it up, and there was probably 400, 500 cassettes like,
oh, wow.
in there. All of like really weird like promo things of records that I don't remember. Like Paul Rutherford, the guy who just danced in Frankie Goes to Hollywood, I had his solo album. Like that was on top there. That's what I remember. And a lot of other junk. But no, I have no nostalgia for cassettes beyond mixtapes.
Hmm.
But cool if other people want to buy it, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
We just did a post on Brooklyn Vegan where I think it was Nirvana's In Utero. They like somebody did like a small run and they sold out in like 20 seconds or something.
I saw that. It was like, I think it was a blue cassette or something. Then mm-hmm. they did a different color or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of coming back. But I think it's like a nostalgia thing, right? Like people are just kind of going back to kind of old media. I don't know that anyone's really going back to CDs. Maybe it's too soon. Maybe they never will, but like,
yeah, I don't know if there's like a, maybe there's not a nostalgia element with CDs.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I guess they still sell CDs, but
they do. Yeah.
So it's not a dead media. But I mean, you know, people have that feeling with vinyl, and that's the thing that's never died, but it has like dips and that, you know,
yeah,
like highs and lows. So where did you grow up? You said you went back home.
I grew up in West Virginia, in the sort of southeastern part of the state, a town called Lewisburg, West Virginia.
Oh, cool.
And when did you move to New York?
1995.
So, like, what brought you to the city?
I was finishing up college, and I worked for my college radio station, and we ran our station ran a syndicated show called Music View that was interviews with bands. That's basically what it was. It's like a half hour interview magazine type show. Mm. And there was an ad in the back of like CMJ magazine, like the trade magazine, not the CMJ monthly that they used to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like a wanted section, and Music View was looking for a new producer. And I was like, I love Music View. I could do this show. I sent them not a demo tape, but you know, air check tape or whatever of me on the air. And 2 weeks later, I was moving to New York and I had no plans of moving to New York before that.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
But you kind of knew that your heart was in music.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Or some form of like entertainment. Like I, you know, I liked movies and TV didn't seem like a viable option for anything, but yeah, movies and music both. Very, you know, very interesting to me. So I jumped at the chance to, you know, to do something and not have to move back with my parents.
Fair. And how long did that last for?
Not that long.
Okay.
The show was sponsored by the Columbia Tape and Record Club.
Wait, the catalog 99-cent thing?
Yep, exactly. Okay. So it was sponsored by them because they, I don't know if you knew this, but Columbia House, the way it worked, they had their own pressing plants for CDs, tapes, and albums. So that's like, they pressed their own like versions of those records. Like you'll see it at the, like, if you look on the back of one of those, it'll say, you know, pressed by Columbia House. And so they had a CD pressing plant in 95. It was crazy expensive to buy like CDRs, but Columbia House would do it and sent out the CDs to the 200 college stations nationwide. And the show ran from, I think, the mid 80s up through 95. Originally it was sent out on either cassette or vinyl.
Hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I guess they had not seen as much value in sponsoring the show anymore. So about 4 months into me moving to New York, they canceled the show, and the company that was doing it, like, that was their sole source of income and definitely my source of my income. So I was out of work like after 4 months of moving here, but you know, you find something else in New York. That's the way it works. So
yeah, it's a hustle here. So yep, where did you go after that?
I actually ended up working for that company again called X Communications, because I was unemployed for a while, and then there was this other thing that came up. And then my first like sort of real good decent job was in like 99. I worked for a online city guide. It was called sidewalk.com. It was owned by Microsoft,
of course. Yeah,
who later went on to make the Zune. And so I started working there as a assistant photo editor, of all things. It was just like a foot in the door job. So I had to call record companies and movie studios asking for publicity photos. But I started bugging like the music, the editorial side when I started working there, and ended up doing reviews. And then I became the local live music editor. So I had to edit like other writers, like little blurbs for what shows were going on in the week. So I was, you know, very similar to like what I do now for Brooklyn Vegan, but I was doing that in like 99.
Oh, well, full circle kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I had a bunch of dumb like .com jobs throughout the 2000s, including a few years at barnesandnoble.com. And
oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
And then how did you like, cause you were also in the blogger game.
Sure. The old blogger game. Yeah.
How did that all kind of come about with Soundbites? That was your blog,
right? Soundbites was the blog that I did, and that started in 2005. And it basically started out with I was working at Barnes & Noble, and it was one of those, back in the day, you had jobs where maybe you had a little more free time than you do now. At least Barnes & Noble I did. And so to fill that downtime, you know, I started this blog. I also, like, it felt like, to me, there was this, like, group of New York blogs where everybody was friends, and they sort of seemed to start, I felt like they started blogs because their friends had one and they wanted to have one too.
Yeah.
And they all wrote about the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And I hated half of the stuff that they were writing about.
Yeah.
And I thought that I came to music with like at least a slightly older, different perspective. And so I started from that. That's basically like how it started, just out of fun. And then that turned into a weekly column writing for Brooklyn Vegan a few years later. And then it turned into like a job.
Yeah, you were their like first full-time employee, right?
That's right. I was the first full-time employee outside of Dave, who started Brooklyn Vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're a senior editor over
now
there?
I'm senior editor. That may just be because I'm old.
No, I feel like you have a big impact on the content and the direction of that blog.
Sure, yeah.
Like, so.
No, we're now a four-person staff. Everybody, you know, does a little bit of everything. So everybody has their areas of expertise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I really feel like, you definitely cultivated like a taste in music with sound bites, and that's definitely like carried over into the Brooklyn vegan world. And you used to do like your kind of, it was kind of like a mixtape thing on sound bites that you were doing, and you had different people do covers for, right?
Yeah, I did a I started doing a thing called Summer Fridays,
Yeah.
where it was just a downloadable mix, an hour long, and new and old stuff. So yeah, that was totally mixtape inspired, 100% mixtape inspired. And
Those are good.
yeah, some of them are good. Some of them are still up. I don't know if you can download them or not, but they're on like Mixcloud, and sure, you can go to Soundbites NYC and see how I haven't updated the blog in 3 years.
I'm glad that it's still up.
But it's still
Yeah,
up
me
there.
too.
Yeah, I am too. Like, there are blogs where I'm like, I wonder, like, if I could, there was this post that I could read, and so much stuff is gone.
Yeah.
That's I've worked for so many dot coms over the last 20 years where everything that I wrote for them is completely unavailable. It's just wiped out. And
Yeah.
so for that reason, I'll pay the every other year GoDaddy fee to keep sound bites going, so people can read all my typos and listen to the occasional mix. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to. I didn't do this yet, but I'll have to dig. Like, I definitely did one of the covers for you for Summer
Oh
Friday.
yeah.
Like, way back when I was doodling more. That was cool, and I feel like you're carrying it over a little bit. I don't know, like, with the indie basement thing. I don't know. Like, it's still kind of like a cool mix of
Yeah, I
like,
love that feature.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
And I should say that Jin, I'm pretty sure Jinners was the first like blog that I ever knew existed.
Oh,
Like,
really?
yeah. Even
Wow.
like I probably knew that the modern age was there, and maybe I knew about FlexBlog, but yours was definitely the first because it was very helpful as a New York music lover, because you did show listings
Oh,
and
yeah.
like cool sort of DIY type stuff. And I definitely like went to see shows because I found out about them through you. And I also will say that Dave has told me, and I don't think that I'm out of turn saying this, that that he was very inspired by your blog when he started Brooklyn Vegan.
Oh, that's nice
Oh,
to hear.
wow.
Yeah.
Because I do remember like Brooklyn Vegan and in the early days, like being, remember when we would have blog rolls on the side of the blog and you'd list like all your blogger friends
Right, yeah.
and stuff like that. So that is nice to hear, like the feedback from you and to hear that from Dave, because I feel like it's like, to me, it's almost like another life.
Yeah, I
And
mean,
it's hard to have perspective when it's yourself, So that's pretty cool.
yeah.
Yeah, I think I also just like it was a diary kind of too. So not only was I like posting just like, hey, check out this show, or like here's all the
Right.
shows that are coming up that you should check out, like so many random bits of like my life are on that blog,
Sure.
so.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing, about blogs back then. They were more about a like you read them because it was a not just about the music, but also like the person behind them, and it was a person, it was
Yeah.
it wasn't like a giant thing,
Yeah. I feel like a lot of the blogs have died, and like, Brooklyn Vegan, it's like kind of cool that it's still like indie and like it's still like Dave running stuff,
Yeah, it's
but
we still definitely like have a lot of the same voice. We definitely have the same color palette,
yeah.
and the same logo. And
What
what
I
I
whenever I have to
appreciate.
take out an ad, it's always like Dave handling it. So I just like appreciate that so much.
What I love is that A, that it's independent, of course, and but B, that there's no one at the top saying, you know what, maybe we shouldn't cover this act, but we should cover the new Ariana Grande single because that's going to get us more clicks. It isn't, I mean, obviously clicks matter, but it isn't only about clicks. And I feel like some of the sites that are still kicking, if you look at the content, it's all mainstream stuff and it's all stuff that gets the obvious click-throughs. And I really appreciate that Brooklyn Vegan in particular hasn't gone down that route where it's only, you know, top tier, top 40 kind of acts.
Right. You know, we definitely cover more pop than we used to, but it's also a result of the people that like work there and the way things are. Like, you know, streaming has really changed the way people listen to music. And when I was growing up, it was very much an us versus them, you know, a college radio alternative. You know, you listen to that, you did not listen to Top 40. You know, you did not put Whitney Houston and Husker Du on the same mixtape unless you're Rob Sheffield.
Exactly.
You know, but now, you know, it all just comes into the algorithm, and it's okay for people to like Ariana Grande and Animal Collective and Arctic Monkeys and all the rest, whatever else comes up in A, you know?
It's true.
And while I have not maybe like crossed that hurdle personally, you know, some of the rest of the staff are way more open-minded, and, you know, I think it's cool that everything is like now on sort of a more level playing field. But yeah, I agree. Like sometimes you see other blogs or websites and you're just like, really? You're posting about that? You know, you're posting about the Jet are back and they're about to tour, and you're doing that with no like sense of irony whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. No monkey pissing.
Hey, I you know, I'm not sure what blog you're talking about, you know, site you're talking about, but yes, exactly.
But I agree with what you're saying in terms of like back in the day, everything being kind of segmented. And I guess in my head, the first thing I think of is like 90s radio here in New York. And it was like the alternative station, the hip hop station, the light FM station. And they're really, I mean, you would never hear, you know, Biggie, for example, on any of the other stations. You knew to listen to it mostly on the hip hop and pop station. But right. Now I feel like in general, because of streaming, and maybe this is a good part of streaming, I feel like the zeitgeist is kind of maybe larger. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to describe it really, but it's a little less of like A, B, and C are totally different camps, you know?
Well, access to music has certainly changed. Yeah. You know, and I think that's part of it, is like people have more access to just check out something if they want to, or like all they have to do is click on this link and they're taken to YouTube or something, or a Spotify, or, you know, all the various streaming, you know, options that are out there that you don't have to pay for. So, you know, I think that has opened up probably a lot of people's worlds that maybe, you know, wouldn't have bought the album or something, but now they checked it out. Now they've seen it on some commercial or something. I don't know. Like, I just feel like there's just like way more access, and that definitely changes like the scope of things too.
Yeah. You know, like, in college and stuff, I had the, there was this, book called the Trouser Press Record Guide, and it was just like an indie alternative. You know, you could read about whoever, Throbbing Gristle and REM, and, you know, and there were bands like Throbbing Gristle that I read about. And it's like, this sounds amazing. And you just couldn't find the records anywhere. And so you just had to imagine for years, you know, until I moved to New York and you could go to some place like Kim's or Other Music. And there's a whole giant section, you know, just for them. But before that you couldn't. And now, you know, somebody can hear about this and go on YouTube or Spotify, and instantly they can hear all of, you know, every record they ever put out, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're also sort of overwhelmed by choice as well, which is the downside.
Part of me misses the hunt for the record, even though I grew up in New York. Like, not every store had what I wanted, so it was like trying to find it back in the day. But I think on the flip side of that, I think there's a little less shame for indie kids, or whatever term you want to use, to kind of delve into pop, whereas you didn't really have that as much, I feel like, in the 90s and very early 2000s. Now it's a lot more commonplace, I feel. I don't know.
Yeah, you look. I mean, you look at
TikTok.
There you are.
I thought you were gonna say TikTok. So.
I was sensing it.
I mean, that band from 20 years ago, Life Without Buildings. One of their, you know, super weird, like obscure. Only the indiest of indie people knew about that record at the time. Now, like, became like like an insane viral sensation due to TikTok, and that's amazing, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and that would have never happened before.
I mean, so much music blew up on TikTok. I mean, if we're talking about, like, you know, Doja Cat or Megan Thee Stallion or even like really big stars, you know,
Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, that's actually a really good clip. I mean, I don't know the one that went viral with the Fleetwood Mac song. Yeah,
and it actually affects like their sales. And so, you know, so like it's weird to think that music could have, there's like this new discovery platform that's like totally for like these, like, you know, like 10-year-olds, you know, and they're making things blow up, and it's all about like different kinds of, you know, trends that, you know, I don't completely understand, but sometimes I find pretty entertaining, you know, to watch. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fascinating in that way, how people are discovering music, because it's definitely not how I discovered it. I definitely discovered music on mixtapes, and because I couldn't afford to like really buy albums or anything, so I was very dependent on like what music my friends shared with me and stuff.
Yeah,
so.
that's true. That I think mixtapes, that's probably the most valuable or like part to me too. Like this friend of mine, Toby, who I went to college with, and we did college radio together, and he moved to the West Coast, and we would trade mixtapes and mix CDs, and we still like trade suggestions now, but I've still got some of those, you know, tapes, and I listen to at home when I use my parents' car that still has a tape deck.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice. Awesome.
That's where the nostalgia comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me it was like going to Tower Records and then sorting through like Q or NME and not purchasing it because it was the imported price for a magazine. And at, you know, I think to this day, I wouldn't really spend like $12, $15 on one issue of a magazine. But back then I would spend an hour reading through it and figuring out who, you know, Long Pigs are or Ash, right, or whomever. Uh-huh. And then like, and then kind of seeking out the music, you know? Mm.
I worked, that first job that I had was on Bleecker and Broadway, and on Fridays I would walk down Bleecker to Rebel Rebel.
Mm-hmm. I miss Rebel Rebel. Yeah.
Which was like they had every import imaginable, and they would get them in on the Friday. They're not split. They're like in England, records came out on Mondays, and America, they came out on Tuesdays, but they would get them on Fridays and they would just put it out. Mm-hmm. So like I bought Radiohead's The Bends, you know, 4 days before you were supposed to get it, because I ran down to Rebel Rebel, you know, on that Friday in 97 or whenever it was, you know, or whatever record, and spent, you know, $32 on it that I didn't have to spend. But I would leaf through Select and Enemy and Melody Maker while I was there.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was more like a, I don't know if this is a basic thing, but I was definitely like a Spin.
Sure.
Kind of.
Well, of course.
Girl. I subscribed to Spin.
Yeah, and just finding out about a lot of music, reading that. And I used to be like really into art in like high school, and I would like take pictures from Spin and like draw people and stuff like that. I wanted to talk a little bit about like some of your memories during like the blog years, though, like, because I feel like we didn't delve into that too much, but like bands that you were like a big champion of and favorite venues and stuff like that.
Favorite venues, boy, I have a lot of memories of, in the 90s, it was, you went where everybody, like you went to Mercury Lounge to see the British band's first American show, and even through the early 2000s, then they would play Bowery Ballroom the next time they were through. Mm-hmm. And I have, those places have special memories just because I've seen so many shows there. And, that when you see a picture and it's got that, this is not an exit, in the background, you know, it's Mercury Lounge.
Yep.
You remember that You'd think that after 20 years, I would know the lady's name who checked your name at Mercury Lounge. But Jen, do you?
Oh,
do you
Maggie.
Know Maggie.
Oh. You know?
Who some people hate just because she didn't take any shit, but you know.
I fucking respected that.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, you do your job. You know, like. I'm never an asshole to door people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. A lot of places in Williamsburg, you know, I moved to Williamsburg in 98. So it was interesting to see the shift that happened in like 2001 when you used to always go into the city. And then little by little, like you went to the city less.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like the old North Six.
Ugh.
Yeah. Which is now Music Hall of Williamsburg.
Yeah.
And Galapagos.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, of course, all the DIY venues, the corner that had Death by Audio and Glasslands and 285 Kent, all those places.
Cameo.
Cameo that, you know, when it had that weird, whatever that weird sculpture, like hanging sculpture.
Oh, yeah. Like the cool, like. Lights, kind of fringy sculpture thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was cool.
It was.
You know, it was like a statement piece. Like Glasslands always had like that statement piece, like
the clouds.
Yeah, and it was very recognizable. I like when places kind of do that, put their stamp on it. You know,
Galapagos had that reflecting pool when you walked in.
So cool. Mm-hmm. So cool. I remember like ordering from any time, and then,
Right. You know. So for people who don't know what any of these places are, like Anytime was on North 6th Street, and it started as just a 24-hour like food place, and then in the back they made a bar, and they called it Cameo, and they started having shows back there. And I think maybe Cameo just took it over. You didn't really eat there too much unless you didn't have anywhere else to go or something. But.
Right. Like, yeah. It changed names. It wasn't called Anytime anymore. It was
I don't remember. I saw some funny shows at Cameo. I saw Mumford & Sons there.
Oh.
They're in the news recently.
Yes, they were. Yep.
Yep.
As if that show wasn't uncool enough. Yeah, but I'm trying... It was, they played with, do you remember, there was a band from Norway called Casio Kids?
Yeah.
Of course. I was actually into them. Yeah.
Yeah. So they played with Casio Kids, and there was a duo from England. It was like a Moshi Moshi showcase.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And, Moshi Moshi.
Yeah. And so, Mumford & Sons like were first on the bill. There was like 20 people there. Like a year later, they were probably playing Radio City Music Hall or something.
I know. I did a CMJ showcase, I think, at Cameo with like Stark. Remember Stark?
That was a group or a blog?
It was like
or
these
what was...
two guys. They were like brothers.
Oh yeah. Stark Online. Matt and Vin. Vince. Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, they were kind of later era blogging, you know what I mean? A little bit like afterwards. And I had like... probably met them at Siren Festival or something, you know?
Right.
Uh-huh.
I feel like there are some blogs that kind of started a little bit later on in the aughts. But, you know, it was a cool venue. And did you do showcases, too, like, in a bunch of those venues? I know, like...
Well, Brooke, I stayed out of the showcase game myself, personally. Though I did do one for Northside one year. Like, it was like a... This Week in Indie through Brooklyn Vegan sort of thing. It didn't go very well. You know, Brooklyn Vegan, you know, famous for their CMJ day parties. And, you know, for years, we were in the Lower East Side, like at Pianos sometimes. And
yeah, I feel like you've done multiple room kind of stuff.
Yeah, we love to do multiple rooms. Yeah. And we'd had whatever... Was it called Public Assembly? Was that what Galapagos became after Galapagos?
Yeah, it turned into Public Assembly.
Right? So, like, we did Public Assembly, and when it closed, we moved to Babies All Right, which was just one room. Those are the days.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
We actually were reminiscing about an old Brooklyn Vegan showcase on the episode we did with Sharon Van Etten last season.
Oh, with that the one was that, she played?
Yeah, because that was that day was actually my first introduction to her. I saw her at Cake Shop, and then I saw her at upstairs at mm-hmm. at Pianos.
Yeah. I remember that. I remember that Sharon Van Etten show. Yeah, it was
yeah,
upstairs. Yeah, I think she was like she just like sat on the like the table that was normally in that lounge. Part, you know, and played, or maybe she was like sitting on an amp or something like that, but it was very, very like intimate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was great. Yeah.
She may not have even been mic'd. I don't remember.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, it's a small room, so I feel like. So.
Yeah, I used to have showcases there too back in the day. I feel like we should probably hop into Repeat Skip at this point.
Okay.
Let's do it.
And the first album we're going to discuss is, I feel like this was a game changer back in the day. Franz Ferdinand's self-titled album from 2004. Domino put it out. Bill, you want to get started with your memories of this release?
Sure. I have very strong memories of Franz Ferdinand. Mm-hmm. I wasn't as big on like the Strokes and, you know, I liked Interpol, but like that, the sort of like Strokes world, not as much, but Franz Ferdinand were definitely like my sort of thing. I was a big Gang of Four fan, and I like Sparks and stuff like that. And they seemed to sort of combine all that stuff. And I heard them on BBC Six Music, which I used to listen to a lot at my day job. And I feel like they came over in 2003 to play like a weekend of little sort of showcases for labels. Even though I think they had been signed to Domino already. And I believe, I can't say for sure, but I feel like I read about that they were happening on Jenner's.
Oh, that's funny. I saw your note about it and I was like, I just don't remember. Well, that could just be my terrible memory.
their first ever like American show was at Pianos. Mm. And they'd only had out that Darts of Pleasure single mm-hmm. at the time. Right. And there was about 10 people there, and they wore like matching shirts and belts, I remember. And I was like, I was like, wow, this is like next level. And like, I distinctly remember them playing Take Me Out. You know, it's like, oh my God, this is like a hit, you know? And
yeah.
they played two more shows that weekend, and I went to all of them. Mm, nice. They played, what was... It was on the Upper West, or like sort of Midtown West, sort of more of a Velvet Rope club, and they had the fish tank with the mermaids behind them. Do you know what I'm talking about? There were definitely like cool shows there, you know, in the but it was just every once in a while. But they played there, and then they played Mercury Lounge with Fiery Furnaces, and I think that's where Alex and
Eleanor.
Eleanor like mm-hmm. met, you know, and they became a couple, and they lived in Greenpoint, and they were like mm-hmm. the cool Greenpoint couple mm-hmm. a couple years later. So I fell super hard for Franz Ferdinand. And then because of like MySpace, you know, I was like, what do they have in their like top eight? And like, oh, who's this Block Party band? Who's this Art Brute band? And so like, I definitely like discovered other bands from there at the time. This was also sort of like peak early days of Snacky in Williamsburg, mm-hmm. when the whole like RISD crowd, which included Dirty on Purpose and Cheeseburger, all part of the Jenner's world yeah. back then, and it was a little crazier and like debaucherous.
Right.
But like I have memories of listening to like I'd had like a leak of the Franz Ferdinand album, and we were listening to that at Snacky really loud all the time back then. And then they played like a week before the album came out in America, they played a show at North Six, and the record had leaked, and like you could not have fit more people into that show. It was like a hipster prom or something. There were like people were like dressed to the nines, and people were just going crazy for every song. And I remember like watching the band, and they just I think were just taken aback.
Yeah,
you know, they were not expecting
yeah
quite expecting that. And so, you know, that was just, but that, yeah, that was a huge record at the time. And it predated, you know, blogging, except for, I guess Stereo Gum probably existed at that time. But I feel like that sort of era that also, you know, like Future Heads and everything else that was going on, like the Dotsons and the Caesars and all that stuff blew up, like, and started like blogs in some ways, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's true. There was a big, like, kind of British invasion in the indie scene for sure.
Yeah. The other one that I remember like this, Jen, I don't know if you were at this. Were you at the Chick 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 release party that was on the boat?
Was I on the boat?
It was for Loud Enough Now.
I can't remember. I feel like I would remember if I was on a Chick 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 on a boat.
Yeah, I think you would. I mean, unless, you know.
There was a lot of boat shows. There were
too many sparks, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that intake. Too. But I had like a love-hate relationship with Chick Chick Chick, so it's possible that there was probably a show.
You were just like, fuck that?
Well, you know their relationship to bloggers back then was like, they hated them.
Oh, I didn't realize that, but.
Well, yeah, no, they don't want anyone up front taking pictures. They would throw water at you if you were doing it, and sometimes that would like offend me. But at one point, I turned and then I loved them, and then I was like, okay, let's dance.
Yeah,
yeah. I caved also. I saw them on New Year's Eve. I don't even remember how many years ago, and I was like, okay, this okay, I get it now. Yeah, something turned.
Yeah.
But yeah, that show that was on, you know, it's on one of the boats that they use now for the Rocks Off cruises or whatever. I'm pretty sure that there had never been a show like that before. I felt bad for the staff who were not prepared for the, I'm sure, drug-fueled, drug and alcohol-fueled shenanigans that were, there was like a drop ceiling. There was a drop ceiling on the floor that the show was at, and there were like people on other people's shoulders, and they were like trying to tear down the drop ceiling. And I was I'm 5 years older than most of that crowd, at least, and I was definitely thinking, like, oh, you shouldn't do that. And
right exactly.
And I, like, there was a point, like, we might die out here tonight, but this is pretty fun. But
I kind of feel, though, like Chick Chick Chick, Franz Ferdinand, you know, some of the bands you mentioned earlier, Future Heads, it kind of brought a sense of dance and fun back into indie. And that kind of corresponded with all the dance parties, obviously Misshapes and the Motherfucker Party and so on. Yeah. But I feel like it was the first time in a while that people kind of felt like amped up to move, you know?
Yeah. And it was also an era when you'd go to a DJ party and people would be playing current indie music and people were going crazy for it, which I don't think happens much now. I mean, I don't know, nothing's happened in the last year, but even before that, not like I went to a lot of like indie dance parties, but it, you know, that era of like Hot Chip and
Kaiser Chiefs
Kaiser Chiefs and I don't know, New Young Pony Club and stuff like that, you know, like it was a real, you know, people were into it, you know, and you heard it everywhere, or the Killers and that sort of stuff, you know. It was very current, whereas now I feel like there's more nostalgia again, but again, I don't go to young people's things anymore.
Yeah, I feel like we're a little over the hill. But yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Killers, because I feel like, in a way, even though it's kind of cringy now to even talk about the Killers, like that Hot Fuss album was so huge. And I kind of align it in a way with this Franz Ferdinand album, because they came out around the same time and they were both like heavy in the sense of, I don't know, like big indie hits and things people wanted to sing along and dance to.
For sure. Know? I was never a Killers fan in any way, shape or form, but they were better than the Bravery. I'll give you that. So,
I was just thinking about the Bravery.
Well, we have to have a Bravery episode at one point.
The Bravery is a reason, one of the reasons why I actually started Soundbites, was because there were so many people like going on about the Bravery. And I remember, like, I'll go, okay, you know, there was no music. There was just show, like they were playing a lot. And they played Mercury Lounge. Like, all right, I'll go see this band. And I went and I just sort of stood like mouth agape. Like, and I was like looking around. I was like, are people really taking this seriously? Like, it was just like the worst thing I had ever seen. And I was like, we need people writing about good groups, not this garbage.
Yeah.
So that, you know.
They were hyped, but it was like, it was almost comical how much hype they got that they did not live up to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, I know we're planning to do like a like an aughts one hit wonder kind of episode, and I was doing research into it, and like literally the Bravery comes up in every list.
What was even the, I mean, Honest Mistake, was that the hit?
Yeah. Okay. And I like listened to it recently and I was like, ugh, I don't know. I don't get it. But like, let's go back to the good band, Franz Ferdinand.
Oh yeah, Franz Ferdinand. I think that record is, you know, I don't think they ever like were able to figure out quite how to make a second record that was as good. You know, they sort of kept doing the same thing. And I don't know. I still like songs off the other records, but that first record is just all hits, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. I feel like that album was like lightning in a bottle and you can't really match that twice, I feel. And I think it's also kind of a tricky thing because it was such a huge moment. It's like, where do you go from there? Do you change it up entirely? Do you try and imitate the first one? And I don't think they've ever really found their footing post the debut, really.
Yeah. But I went to see them play at Warsaw 2 years ago, I guess. It was like an after GovBall show or something. And they were still fantastic, you know, to see live. But even if I didn't really care much about the most recent record that they made.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just like interesting to like note that this self-titled album back in 2004 got Grammy nods. And like, I think like that is just fascinating to me. And I feel like that back then there, it was starting to, you know, indie was starting to cross over into that mainstream consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so they were getting, I mean, just like it was nominated for best alternative album. Remember the term alternative album?
Sure.
Like, I think they still use it, actually.
I'm sure.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
But, like, it sounds so dated to me.
I know. Like, you know. Well, everything Grammys is kind of, yeah.
You know, it's like calling something new media or something. It's just like an old term.
Jin, in your research, did you happen to note who actually won? Because it wasn't Franz Ferdinand.
No, who won?
I don't know.
Oh.
But I just know because like the person whoever it was that I liked never wins. So
yeah, it was.
While Jin
them.
Discusses her memories, I'm gonna look it up. Who won that?
I mean, to me, I don't have too many. I mean, like it's like funny because I feel like I got into this Brit rock thing a little bit later because I was. I don't know, you know, my blog in the beginning was all about like the Walkman and stuff like that, so I feel like my musical tastes were kind of a little bit more on that end and not as like poppy stuff, and but I mean you can't deny how catchy Take Me Out is, and also I like Alex's voice a lot, and I think the songs on this album were like really solid actually and very catchy, and you know, they definitely had like this style that really worked for them, musical style, and like so I was really happy when you chose this album to talk good. about, so I was just like, yes. I have one memory of Franz Ferdinand. I can't remember where it is, but it was somewhere like, I feel like it was like kind of Chelsea or like, you know, that kind of area of Manhattan, and they were having some kind of party with like Kaiser Chiefs or something, and I remember taking a picture
because it was 2004.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember like being there with like Doug from Dirty on Purpose. I don't know if he had something to do with them at the time, I'm trying to remember, but maybe it was like, I don't know. He was doing something. And or maybe it was like through Annie Hart of Wasimo, and there might have been like a connection there. For whatever reason, I was there hanging out and it was just like chill. What was like your favorite on this album, Bill?
I mean, I definitely like OD'd on Take Me Out when it first came out, because I heard it live first and I was just like waiting to hear the studio version, and like you just knew that it was going to be the single, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it was cool to hear that now, and I like that. But I think like probably "Dark of the Matinee" is my favorite song off that record. It's just a little different, you know. It kind of goes in some different directions, you know, and mm-hmm. in the middle of it and stuff, and it's kind of slinky, mm-hmm. Which is how I would be a good word just to describe that record in general. But I think it was still like a hit, but it wasn't quite as overplayed as "Take Me Out" became. But there were some good B-sides from that era too.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to do an episode of B-sides, and you can go back and talk about it.
Episode is a good idea.
Yeah, no, I chose "Dark of the Matinee" too, and I definitely feel like there's like a sensualness to the song, and then at times when it kind of like speeds up a little bit, I really feel like it captures like a feeling, like the feeling that when I think about the aughts is like, just, you're just running around like everywhere and going from this to that and running into this person and that person. And I feel like it kind of captures that magic of that era for me. So I kind of, it brought back a lot of memories just listening to it.
Yeah.
So the album that won Alternative Record of the Year in 2004 was "A Ghost Is Born," Wilco.
Oh, that's okay, I guess.
Yeah, but and the other nominees were Bjork, Medulla, PJ Harvey, Aha Her, and Modest Mouse, "Good News for People Who Love Bad News."
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, Franz Ferdinand were the only like debut album that's on that list, and the rest, you know, rest very, very safe Grammy type nominations. So.
Exactly.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have too much else to add. I feel like we touched upon all the great elements of this album. I think it, you know, unlike a lot of records from this period that were kind of buzzy, I think it does stand the test of time.
Yes.
And I mean, I love almost every track on this record. I mean, obviously "Dark of the Matinee," obviously "Take Me Out." I love the opening track, "Jacqueline."
Ooh, yeah.
And I think that really sets the tone. And I think, if I were to choose, I might choose "Michael" as my favorite.
Oh.
I think just because, I don't know, something about that song is obviously very homoerotic. And I just kind of feel like at that time I was single and I was out and I was dancing. And I would hear that song and it'd be like, something about it was kind of like magical for me. I don't know. But I mean, this whole record I think is really great.
That's funny because I picked that as my skip. And I was like, but I can see like what you're saying about the homoeroticism, because I think I found this quote that where Alex was talking about the song, and he said, "It was one night when me and the band were out with friends from Glasgow, and we went to the warehouse dance party thing called Disco X. It was a very debauched night with these two friends, and these two friends got it together in a very sexy way."
Yeah.
I definitely got it, but I don't know. Some of the lyrics are kind of cringy for me, but maybe I'm just a prude. So, I don't know.
And my skips would be either "Cheating on You" or "Tell Her Tonight." But I mean, I don't hate them. It's just if I were to pick one.
Yeah, same for me for skips. I chose "Come On Home," but I actually like that song. I like the whole record, but you know, like there's probably a couple that are similar to their, you know, to the bigger songs and are maybe slightly unnecessary. But as far as like mid-aughts records go, when CDs suffered from like CD bloat, you know, where they filled up a CD just because they could, you know, this record, I think it's like 43 minutes or something. It's mm-hmm. like the perfect length. So
yeah,
I got no problems with anything off this record actually.
Yeah, I mean, "Come On Home," I really like when he sings like "home" and it kind of goes, it's like soft and goes kind of up. And I couldn't really put my finger on it, but it reminded me of like another band. But I think that's why I gravitated towards it, and it sounded really nice. It had like a really nice sound too. And "Tell Her Tonight" and "Cheating on You." Yeah, I don't know. "Tell Her Tonight" kind of, I think I realized it kind of reminded me of like "Hot Hot Heat," who I'm not like that hot about.
Oh.
So,
I love that record when it came out, the first one.
Yeah, we discussed that in a recent episode. Oh. It was funny to revisit
it's,
that one.
It's hard
yeah.
to go back and listen to it. You'll see what we mean. Like,
oh, all right. Yeah, I haven't listened to it in a while. Yeah. I saw them at, speaking of Williamsburg venues that don't exist anymore, I saw them at Lux.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Lux.
Yeah.
That's like my old home. Like, I remember, I have so many memories of Lux because I used to like promote shows there. But
yeah, I saw Dirty on Purpose there once.
They were like the house band there for a while. I think that's like before I started managing them. They were playing there like every week or something yeah. like that. But no, like when you have other bands like covering your songs, I feel like that's a level of success that's like really like a compliment in a lot of ways. And I feel like Take Me Out was so huge and got covered by so many bands. And also, like, if Weird Al Yankovic uses your song in a song, like, that's
yeah,
another
you're,
level.
You're minted. You're minted.
Yeah. yeah. So. But should we talk about the next album?
Sure.
Yeah.
So the next album you chose was Flaming Lips, Soft Bulletin from '99. So excited you chose that. So good. You want to tell us some of your memories of this one?
Yep. I was working at Sidewalk.com this year, and everything is very, for whatever reason, '99 is very crystal clear to me. Like every movie, like, you know. But I remember I got an advanced CD of this album. You know, it just came in like a plain wrapper or whatever. And it was one of these where it was months before it was coming out in America. Like it came out in England like a month before it came out in America. But anyway, I put it on and, you know, I liked Flaming Lips before, but I never loved them. And something about this record, like, you know, it was a Garden State moment for me. It changed my life. Like I would not shut up about Soft Bulletin. Like that whole summer of '99, which was insanely hot. I remember that. I'd be like, you guys, you have to hear this new Flaming Lips record. It's amazing. And they're like, does she don't use jelly band?
Yeah.
And like, no, this is completely different. Like the band that you had to have four CD players to listen to their album band. Like this one is like that, but it's just one CD. Like this is
I
all
was actually going to mention Zarika when it was my turn, but yeah, go ahead.
And it moved me. Like it hit me like on a deep, deep level that I had not experienced. Like, since I was a teenager, and I was, I had just turned 30 when this record came out.
Yeah.
To the point where, I mean, I went to Rebel Rebel and bought the import the day it came out. And then when it came out in America, I actually bought this record for other people, like out of the blue. I just like show up at the place. Oh, I bought you the Soft Bulletin. You're gonna love this record. and then I would do like follow-up calls. You know, like, so did you listen to that? No, but did you listen past Race for the Prize? You know, like, like you get really got to listen to it with headphones on. You know,
yes. And, it is one of those albums.
It's a headphones album.
It might be the last record that like genuinely like changed my life. And I remember they toured for that record. It was this special tour. They called it like the Music Against Brain Degradation Tour. Where it was a whole bunch of bands. It was them, Sebado, Robin Hitchcock, Cornelius, and maybe this band called Q and Not You.
Okay.
Oh, I love Q and Not You.
Yeah.
And so, now that guy writes for Washington Post, by the way.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He's the music editor there.
Because like there was a gimmick with everything with the Flaming Lips in that era, like it was broadcast in stereo, so they gave you radio Walkmans when you went in the venue. There was at Tramps, which was this venue that was on 21st Street, I think, like by 6th Avenue. And so you got a little radio like Walkman, and so you had the show in stereo while you were there, which most people didn't use. And it was a cooler idea than it was in actuality, because I'm blanking on his name, the drummer, he played so much of the
Steven
music. Steven Drozd.
Yeah.
Stephen Drozd was not playing drums like on that tour. They just had pre-recorded drums because he was like playing the guitar parts, and on, like Wayne Coyne had switched to just being a frontman instead of being a not very good guitarist, you know. And there were lots of like stunts, like he would pour blood on himself at that show, and he had that big gong, but they hadn't quite figured out the live show. And the other problem is the drums on that record are like so amazing, so big, so huge. You wanted to see somebody playing them live, and it was a bit of a disappointment when that didn't happen. They figured it out since. I would not shut up about the soft bulletin, and I also got to see an early screening of Fight Club, and I would not shut the fuck up about that movie either. So I think people who knew me then knew me for those two things for that year.
I loved Fight Club too.
Yeah, no, I mean, who could forget Fight Club if you've ever seen it? Like,
yeah,
it's a crazy movie. But what about you, Matt? What are some of your Flaming Lips memories?
So, I mean, I have a similar kind of trajectory as I think most people, where it's like, obviously, She Don't Use Jelly was a big radio hit, and I was familiar with that, but not super into it. And then in college, you know, we did the Zurika experiment with the different sound systems and different CDs and one ear over here and then one ear over there. And we went in circles, that whole thing.
Yeah.
And then this came out when I was a college radio DJ. And I have to say, this paired with Yoshimi for me are the pinnacle of Flaming Lips fandom personally. I kind of have not had much interest in them since then, to be honest. And I kind of find them to be super like shticky and ridiculous now, but I think these two albums are incredible that they put out right around the millennium. This album I think is pretty flawless, honestly, and I would say my two favorites are the first two tracks, Race for the Prize and A Spoonful Weighs a Ton. It's just, it's so, something about it is just so moving, so pretty, so honest, and yeah, definitely a different direction, and I think a more, I don't know, sentimental direction or something like that. Yeah.
I also, same thing. First memory is like She Don't Use Jelly, right? Which is like silly. It was like some kind of MTV hit, you know.
They played it on Beverly Hills 90210 in the Peach Pit.
You know, it's kind of like when you, you know, we've talked about Not a Surf in the past, but if you only knew Popular, you know, you wouldn't have, you know, it's like a totally different thing.
Yeah.
But what I was reading about Soft Bulletin is that his songwriting changed. Wayne Coyne's songwriting changed because everybody in the band was going through all these like crazy things. Like Wayne's dad had cancer, and you know, one of the members of the band you know, almost died in a car crash, and there's another member of the band who claimed he had a really severe spider bite, but it turned out to be heroin. And so he really changed like the way he was approaching songwriting to be more emotional and more personal, and not so like these kind of like, I guess they were saying like in past stuff he was doing more like referencing God and I don't know, just like all these like kind of like whatever kind of themes, and that were more broad in general, and this was a more like personal album. And so that was actually interesting to read for me, because when you picked these albums, I started to listen to it earlier in the week. So it was like in a more like, I don't know, positive state of mind earlier in the week. And then I listened to it again after that. And it just struck me completely different on that, listening to it in a sadder state of mind. And so like initially I picked Race for the Prize as my favorite, but now I'm totally all about The Spark That Fled. and I feel like that's an interesting point to like, you know, he was in an emotional state writing it, and how your state of mind can really like affect how you also experience the album, even an album that you know very well. But they actually have a song on there called Spider Bite Song. And basically talking about Stephen Drozd, and he nearly had his arm amputated. And he kept saying that he had the spider bite, but it was actually like an infection from like heroin. And that's really like how the song starts.
Yeah.
You know, and then later on in the song, he starts talking about Michael Ivins, and you know, he was in some crazy car crash. Yeah, and then Waiting for Superman was actually about his father dying from cancer. Ooh. So kind of like just interesting to see like the state of mind of like the artist as well, like, you know, mm-hmm. when they're writing it. But did you guys have any skips on this album?
Zero skips.
Yeah, no.
I usually find something, yeah, but I'm kind of in the same boat. Yeah,
I mean, I guess Sleeping on the Roof is the instrumental, but I think that that's really beautiful too. Like, no, there's maybe Spider Bite sort of feels a little separate in some ways. Like, I feel like either the UK or the American, one of the versions doesn't have that song on it. Mm. Or there's another song that's called like Buggin'. Is that on the ones you have?
Yeah, the Buggin' one. That's a little goofier.
But no, there's no song that I don't like love on this record. And I think the one that I go back to, or that I end up putting on like mixes or whatever, is Feeling Yourself Disintegrate. Like, it's a little more in like his like old psychedelic style, but it's still very like moving, you know, like.
Yeah, I know. It's just so good from start to finish for me. And I just can't fault it. Like, at first I thought I could pick a skip, actually. I'll tell you that. I'll admit that. The first times I was like kind of revisiting it, I was like, but I couldn't quite pick one. It took me, and then listening to it through the sad lens, I was like, actually, I can't pick any of these songs. These are all amazing.
I would say to people who have not heard this record and just know the Flaming Lips from this sort of goofy, very sticky, like live performance that they do now with the bubbles, which is cool, you know, and the confetti cannons and working with Miley Cyrus. Go back and like put this record on and Yoshimi too. But I think this is the better of the two.
Yeah.
And, you know, just put your headphones on or put the stereo on loud and, you know, feel yourself disintegrate a little bit, you know? Is this the first no skip album on Mixtape Memories?
Maybe it's the second, but I can't remember what the other one is.
I think it's the first one where we all agree.
Where all of us say that is the first one.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
It is. What? I think so.
What do I win? I did it.
You get to come back next season.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe it's like a thank you and good night for the podcast.
Yeah. We've just hit the ultimate prize.
Yeah.
I'm going to find it on cassette and mail it to you.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Don't laugh, though. Some of that stuff is actually valuable. Like, I look on Discogs sometimes, and I'm like, who the hell, how is this worth $200 for this cassette that I threw away 25 years ago? But it is, you know. So it's a strange thing, like, the market of all that. But that's a whole other discussion.
Dang, now I have to look up how much all my cassettes are worth.
There is a market. Yeah.
Also, I'll say the record from this year, American Head, or maybe it was last year. I can't remember. I think it was last year. It's really good. Check it out. Okay. Give it a chance. Give it a chance.
Okay.
I'll check it out just because you said.
Okay.
Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of Mixtape Memories, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.